do have a liking. At all. From the perspective of counterpoise. So if you were to answer the question from the perspective of counterpoise, why do really we have a liking? Why is it happening? Enter it here.
I could not tell you on the basis of counterpoise or marbles or copper pennies. As far as I'm aware, it has something to do with cold air and friction and water particles and building up local charges and the Earth being a ground potential for when the charge potential becomes high enough it, and gamma rays excite little bits of gas, they jump from one to the other, priming it as an ion field, and then it goes all the way into the ground where the charges try to equilibrate. That's the best that I could do, not being a lightning specialist, and knowing, as I mentioned earlier, that even lightning specialists have a lot more questions about lightning than they have answers.
Thank you very much, Dr. Roy. From the perspective of an antenna and from the perspective of counterpoise. From the perspective of an antenna, nature likes the balance. That's why the counterpoise gives you the balance. At given impedance of 50 ohm, and that's why you have an antenna. Now, if there is a discharge, right, is because nature likes the balance. And the counterpoise, which is the ground, are exactly as a counterpoise to give the balance, which is zero. And that's why you have a discharge. Do you agree with that?
No. I think that the universe wants a balance of charges. And there's a charge differential, not an electromagnetic difference. There's a charge differential. In some cases, there's much more electrons above the Earth than at the Earth, and so eventually the potential breakthrough, the breakdown voltage of the atmosphere, and it goes to ground. So I don't perceive it as fundamentally an RF thing. I perceive it as a movement of current, because it is a movement of current. It happens to generate a secondary electromagnetic field. In RF and in light. That's what the lightning is. But fundamentally, it's a movement of charge from one potential to another potential across the atmosphere onto the ground.
I have a problem with the statement because you're leaving completely around the element of frequency. And then you're talking about the electromagnetic field, which is the element of frequency of variable the component. So if there is a variable component, and there is that variable component that is present, then your answer is not complete. Because the variable component gives us the ability to treat it at least theoretically as the resonant circuit. For the AC, not for the DC. So we have a discharge just because the Earth has given frequency is acting as the counterpoise for the antenna, which is the lightning path. That's what she
is. Well, what can I tell you? I humbly disagree. I think the electromagnetic emissions are secondary to the electrostatic discharge. And I believe Mark, another listener of ours, says New Jersey listener on the web, he wrote, the lightning is is static electricity on a grand scale. It is an electrostatic direct current discharge. So, once again, it's still up in the air because you're not going to find anyone with a whole row of PhDs who will definitively give you an answer. But the way that I perceive it is it's primarily a case of the movement of charged particles from one place to another, which produces ionization, which produces electromagnetic waves. It is not electromagnetic waves producing a charge current traveling, but it's an actual bunch of charge potentials going to equilibrium down on the ground, and the current manifested will produce as a byproduct illumination, intense heat, thunder, noise, and also, you know, sundry electromagnetic emissions. Six of one, half a dozen of the other. I understand that you disagree.
I really think that you're trying to treat the rising airdrop in the impulse as a DC. It's not a DC. When you have any variation to the DC, then you have AC. DC doesn't discharge. And if you have a change of the static electricity, you don't have a frequency. You just have a change. You have a transfer. Discharge at given frequency is the AC phenomena, is the rising edge of an impulse. And it's not DC, it's AC. Only when it is established at a certain level, we're dealing with AC. So we say that our impulse starts from let's say, 20,000 volts, this is DC. But when it drops or it changes its level, then we're dealing with AC. That's why we have a frequency. And the frequency requests an antenna that has a certain resonant property. That's why I have a problem to understand. Or maybe my English is not good enough to understand your point.
Okay. Alternating current does not necessarily mean changing current. It means alternating from one direction to another and then back again. Lightning does not alternate. Lightning can change its intensity, but it's always going in the same direction. That's why people call it direct current. It is not stable direct current. It is not steady direct current. But it is direct current because it is only traveling in one direction. There is no portion in a lightning bolt where the current is reversing itself.
Dr. Roy, if you analyze on your oscilloscope the rising edge and falling edge, this is DC. This is AC. The DC is when there is no change. Anything that is in equilibrium is in balance. But anything that is at a certain level is DC. Now, when you're changing that DC, then you're dealing with the AC component. Now, you can pull that AC component, and it's not going to look like AC, like DC. No. It's going to be AC. It's going to be ringing pattern when you're looking at the falling edge. That's why the generators, the good generators, they have very, very short and very sharp rising edge edges from the both sides. And why the old generators had the millisecond rising edge and falling edge? Because they weren't able to make it in nanoseconds right now. So I'm sorry, but maybe somebody else can put some kind of argument into it here.
You've never heard of pulsating DC? You're arguing. Listen to what he said and shut up.
Do you have a call sign, sir?
I do, AM2P. I'm sick of your crap.
What is your call sign?
Learn to listen. Alpha, Foxtrot, 2, Papa.
I do very much appreciate it, but your nice behavior. Thing is, I'm really struggling to make my communication in English language good enough and communicative. And you're trying to treat the person who, let's say, is disabled by making a joke on him or telling him shut up because he cannot walk straight, right? So if you happen to do not understand something, you are just piece of something that I don't really appreciate. And your behavior is really very much un-nice and not really in ham radio way, the way that we are actually have a license for. So you're actually treating me with my ability to explain and me trying to make a point as that handicapped person who you're just pushing and punching because you don't like it. Shame on you.
IWUA.
Sorry.
Very much. You were clear in what you just said, and I understood the message. Not that I necessarily agree, but I do okay, you finally said something that is clear. And as to handicap, you got a brain. You are not handicapped. That's bull.
Maybe you need Dr. Roy explanation what is handicap. Inability to perform like anybody else that is similar to you. Inability that is not up to you because you're not able in that very moment to actually perform the same way. You are actually behaving very bad right now. Shame on you.
Gentlemen, this is AC2GS. Let me see if I have my repeater. Very good. I don't think there's a point in this particular conversation. The people are getting upset and annoyed with each other, and as I always kind of mention, if you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. Wesley, once again, this kind of falls into a semantic disagreement, and, you know, maybe at your leisure you can check up the definitions of things, because we seem to stray into some weird world where direct current means different things to the two of us. To me, direct current means it's always in the same direction. It can be intermittent. It can be very intermittent. It can be rapid. You can spike a one-way current any number of frequency cycles, but it's still a direct current. It is not alternating. Alternating infers, in my understanding, that the direction of the current changes direction, which is not the same as a pulse direct current. So I think we're getting in too much of a semantic conversation and argument, and it's kind of breeding a bad sensibility among people, and it's already 10:22. So I think we should kind of put this particular topic to bed tonight. You want to bring it up in future, you're perfectly free to, but I would check on the definition of direct current, just to kind of check whether I'm right or you're right, because I think I'm right about what direct current means.
Dr. Roy, thank you very much. I appreciate your point. You have a full right to be right. And if we're talking about lightning, we're talking about the frequencies. It means the frequencies attached to the lightning. So it's not a DC phenomenon, it's AC phenomenon. It's not only charge exchange. Because then we're going to be talking about charge exchange conditions instead of discharge. So, and those are two different things in physics. Thank you very much. I appreciate it, and I thank you for the time giving me on the net. I'm sorry, I'm just excited. And thank you.
Well, you're welcome, Wesley. Anyone with any closing comments before we move our focus to the space map?
VHG, quickly.
NY2H, just wondering, how did Dick usually end the technet?
Be kind to each other.
And he would also say, give that man a cigar.
Yes, indeed. We stand on the shoulders of giants. I would have loved to find out if he just came up with that, or he pulled it, because it's a quote from the Bible too. So in you know, these years I've always kind of wondered whether it came from the Bible or it just came from his goodwill towards men.
PhD, what a helpful comment.
Certainly, Jim.
I was thinking that some people seem to be attempting to understand science by studying nature, and others seem to be attempting to understand nature by studying science, and there's a distinct difference, and it's a place for the philosophical net, which we haven't done in a while. I've enjoyed even the conflict tonight. Thanks for what you do, Roy. Good job. KD2VHD, clear.
Thank you, Jim. My attitude is science is a means to an end. It is a methodology to help develop explanations and models for things that we don't yet know, to disprove them or prove them, or to further our understanding. We apply that tool to many different sciences, but, you know, science is not in and of itself. It is simply the best method that I know of at this point to learn the greater mysteries of this universe we find ourselves in. So anyway, I want to thank everyone who participated tonight. I want everyone to check their pulse and their blood pressure, make sure it's not too high, not to take any of this too seriously. Again, if you're not having fun, you're doing it wrong. So please, try and relax and take it a little bit easier. Let's get on the pulse of US2N with the SpaceNet report.
AC2GS, WS2N, still here. And I always believe science is the candle in the dark. So, big fan. Wish I was better at it, but what are you going to do? Two topics tonight. Yeah. Lucy spacecraft, which is destined to go to the Trojan asteroids in the Jupiter orbit, was launched exactly 1 year ago today. So now it's gone completely around the sun. But it doesn't have enough oomph to get all the way to Jupiter. It was launched on a Atlas 401 rocket, by the United Launch Alliance, ULA. And, it went all the way around, and now it's coming past Earth for a gravity assist. And it came within 220 miles of Earth. By doing that, it picks up speed a little over 4 miles per second. It will gain by doing what it's doing. And still not fast enough because it's going to go around the sun again. And about 2 years, it'll be back again. And it will do another gravity assist for final push out to Jupiter. So it'll get to Jupiter's orbit eventually, a few years from now. It will be hopefully sending information back to these long-sought asteroids. There's a group of asteroids in front of Jupiter called it's the L5 position, Lagrange point 5. If you were to draw like an equilateral triangle between Jupiter and the sun and off in a forward direction near the orbit of Jupiter, that grouping of asteroids would be the first group that it's going to visit. And then it'll constantly be moving. It's not going to orbit the asteroids, but then eventually it'll start coming back toward Earth again. In many years later, I think probably somewhere in the 2030s, it will go to the other group of asteroids lagging behind Jupiter, another equilateral triangle between the sun, Jupiter, and the area behind it. As it travels, that grouping, another group of asteroids that will visit. So hopefully it all works out. Lucy has these massive circular solar panels, about 25 feet in diameter each. And they were supposed to completely open up right after launch and then lock into position. But the one on the port side didn't lock, didn't get far enough. So they worked on it. They sent commands, pulling on different line units and high attention. And eventually it tightened up to a point where it almost latched, but not quite. But it's got such tension on it where they're not really worried about, anything getting loose. The missions won't be canceled. The only little change they made is when they came close to Earth today, they didn't come as close as they wanted to. They wanted to come a little closer, pick up a little bit more speed. But they kept it around 220 miles, which is, it's actually below the orbit of the International Space Station and thousands of satellites that we have going around the Earth. So they had to make sure that, you know, it was coming through an area where it wasn't going to intersect with a satellite. But if it did, Lucy would have fired its thrusters for, you know, a second or two, and it would have avoided that. So that's the story on Lucy. Hopefully it will send back science some years from now from Jupiter. And they ran tests. They wanted to make sure the cameras and everything were working good. So as it was coming closer to Earth, they actually took pictures of the moon, looking at. They wanted to see how clear the pictures of craters were on the moon. See how that was. You know, they expect to see some craters and rubble when they eventually get to these asteroids. Any comments or questions? WS2N.
Envoy 2H.
H. Yeah. How you doing, Lou?
I'm doing okay. So, they want to avoid satellites, of course. When the Russians blew up that satellite, made all that debris, is that the realm of being a problem also, or no?
Yeah, that's going to be a problem years to come, from what I read. It's going to go off like a 12-gauge shotgun, you know, just spreading all over and that type of deal. When it hit, it created like a linear line of debris, and it's, you know, stretching out in that orbit, that it was in, and it keeps getting longer and longer. So they expect that to be a problem for years to come. After it happened, soon afterwards, some of the debris was getting within the range of the International Space Station, so they moved the space station a little bit. And if that happens with some of the satellites that are up there, those active satellites will have to move. So, I'm sure that was all considered. That and like 6,000 or so satellites that this thing had to pass by just to do that flyby for the gravity assist rule. Back below. Okay, very good. Well, thanks for the question, Lou. There's been many different companies, dozens of them, that have started up. Some of them have gotten big, like SpaceX, and now Rocket Lab. You know, they're very successful now, launching one satellite after another. Some of the new ones have pretty large rockets, like Firefly. They've gotten a couple of rockets off the ground. The last one successfully went into orbit. And then there's a couple of smaller companies that are trying to do the same as well. Astra has gotten a rocket into orbit, but they failed to dispense the small satellites that they had on it. There's another company now. Well, they've actually been working on a rocket for the last 6 years or so. And it's called Blue Shift. Blue Shift is, everybody has their little angle, and this guy, this one company, which is very small, they only have like 12 employees, but they're developing some kind of a fuel, a non-toxic fuel, the new way of doing things is, you know, everything's got to be green, you know, so there's a couple of companies developing different propellants for the satellites themselves that are green. When Dream Chaser comes back and lands, it's going to have what they consider a green thruster fuel on board. Right now, the ones that they use are carcinogenic. They use hypergolic fuels that are, you know, if you inhale them, you could possibly get cancer out of it. But, you know, the newer fuels are starting to be developed. And this company, Blue Shift, has developed some kind of a fuel that they're getting out of farms. They heard an interview on TV, but the guy didn't describe it that good. He did say that you know, I mean, you wouldn't want to do it, but you could actually eat this fuel. It's actually biodegradable. And so it's a very clean fuel, and they just tested their first rocket, very small rocket. You know, only went up a couple of miles, had a parachute, came back and landed. But they expect to, within a couple of years, actually get to orbit with one of their rockets. They're going to call it Stardust Rocket. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot of new companies worldwide that are doing things like this, but this one is based on everything, I mean, on this new fuel. You know, not only for thrusters, I mean, they want to use it for main engines. We'll see how they do. And it's a small company. They only have like 12 people working for them. They're up in Maine. And in fact, they tested their rocket from Maine. They already got the okay from NASA to, or Cape Canaveral anyway, to launch from one of their unused launch complexes once their rockets get big enough. Any comments? WS2M. Okay, JPL is, you know, they're always very innovative. Out in California, Jet Propulsion Laboratory has been around forever. Remember, they used to do the Ranger launches where they used to crash the spacecraft into the moon back in the early 60s. They developed the orbital flights to go around the moon. Eventually, developed the surveyor flights that landed on the moon. They're still at it, I mean, after all these decades. And now, they would like to send an orbital spacecraft to Venus, but this time, on a spacecraft, they want to deploy a balloon. In this case, the balloon would be about 40 feet in diameter. And the idea is to be able to, you know, evaluate the planet from the balloon at a low altitude, relatively low altitude, I think they said 180,000 feet, and then you would have the orbiter still going around, and they would use that, you know, for scientific investigations, as well as a repeater for the balloon to send back information to Earth. So, you know, I mean, I've heard this possibility for decades. I mean, actually, the Russians actually did it in the 1980s. They sent a balloon, but, you know, the balloon had no sophistication behind it. It went around, I think it lasted for an hour and a half, and eventually it died. JPL would like to have this thing and be able to actually orbit the planet. But to do that, they needed to make it out of certain materials, so the outside of the balloon has some sort of metallic type of material to it to resist these chemicals that are in the atmosphere of Venus. They have sulfuric acid and things like that. And they would also like to have the balloon go to different altitudes. They'd like to have it, you know, go down lower, investigate what's down lower, and then go back up, and then even go back down again. So how do they do that? So now, instead of just one balloon, it's a balloon inside of a balloon. And so the inside one is, you know, that down at the very bottom is going to contain a tank, and that tank will have helium in it. So let's say you wanted to let this 40-foot balloon go to a higher altitude. It would, you know, it would open up a valve, and helium would go into this inner part of the inner balloon, and then that would give it more lift, and it would go to a higher altitude. Then they have pumps on the inside of this balloon. They want to come back down to a lower altitude again. The pumps would come on and pump this helium that's inside the inner balloon back into the tank, and then the balloon would go back down. And so I thought it was pretty innovative. And they built one. They built a balloon just like this, and they flew it in our atmosphere. They went out to Nevada and let it go. And it, it went up to, I think, about a mile, and then they were able to do it just right. So they could raise the balloon, lower it, and eventually, when the test was over, they brought it all the way down, back to the ground, and eventually did the same thing over again. So they did two tests. So all that remains is to, you know, perfect this thing a little bit more and get a contract to put it onto a rocket and blast it out to Venus with another orbiter. Stack as a repeater, and of course also do science from a higher altitude around Venus. I thought that was pretty cool. Any comments? WS2S. Okay. Nothing heard. Another interesting development by NASA was bringing the crew back from the International Space Station 2 days ago. They had a crew of four, two of which were ham radio operators, but you have Jill Lindgreg, Robert Hines, and Jessica Watkins, along with the Italian astronaut Samantha Cristoforetti. So what they did is they were supposed to actually come down the day before, but there was bad weather at the landing site. They land right near Florida now. So, they do splashdowns. So that was very successful. They have four big parachutes eventually opened up after coming through the atmosphere. After 6 months on the International Space Station, that crew is now back. It's been replaced by another crew. Like, yesterday you had 11 people on board, and now you have four less of what left the space station. Six months of science, and one of the interesting things I liked what Samantha Cristoforetti did. I don't know if you guys have ever seen the movie 2001 Space Odyssey. When the spacecraft was in the beginning of the movie, more or less, they had a rocket heading to the moon, and they showed they had a, let's call her a stewardess, but she's going to serve everybody, food. They showed her walking on a wall, of inside the spacecraft, and she has Velcro on her shoes, and she was just walking up the side, and eventually she would walk completely upside down, and Samantha Cristoforetti was fascinated with this and wanted to do that before she left the space station. So she brought up a similar outfit that they had on in that movie 2001, and sure enough, that's what she did. She must probably put I didn't look at the details yet, but she probably put a Velcro on the walls in certain different spots, and sure enough, she walked all the way upside down. She wanted to see if you really could do it, and of course, no problem. So I thought that was pretty neat. Any comments? Well, okay, so they're back. And then I want to talk about the DARTS, the double asteroid redirection test, which I probably talked about way too much on this net, but anyway, the results came in. They did have a news conference earlier in the week where they pointed telescopes at the asteroid, and they have figured out that it has moved a certain percentage of a degree. So that means their mission was successful. I've covered this a long time on the net, but if anybody wants to know anything else, you just put in DART, NASA DART spacecraft. You're going to get tons of information. The impactor that hit that one asteroid at 14,000 miles an hour, they actually figured out the time from using our telescopes now. They figured out the time that it takes to go for the small asteroid to go around the bigger one. It's a binary system. Normally it took 11 hours and 55 minutes, roughly 12 hours. For one of its orbits. But hitting the asteroid at that speed, that amount of weight, and hitting it dead on, they were able to change the timing of the orbit by 32 minutes. You know, they were hoping for anything over 10 minutes would have been a success in their mind. They got 32 minutes out of it. So it turned out to be very successful, which also changed the orbit, the distance that the two asteroids are to one another. They're actually closer to one another, creating more of a gravitational pull, which by doing that, you're actually pulling the larger one, you know, off its path that it's going on. So both of them have, you know, actually changed in its orbit around the sun, which means theoretically, if it was on the way to hit Earth, it would have been changed, and by the time it got here, it would have been a miss. Any comments? Okay, another mission that I've covered quite a bit here on the net is the Artemis 1, or Space Launch System, that they've been trying to get up now, for years. They were hoping to launch this in 2017, but most recently anyway, they brought it out to the pad in March. They see if everything worked, like a fit test, and then they brought it back to the vehicle assembly building, and they brought it out to the launch complex again, the launch complex 39B, and they were hoping to launch in September, and they ran into some problems, mainly hydrogen leaks. It's a liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen vehicle, in the core stage and in the second stage. The leak was too great. I mean, they expect a little bit of, like, vapor to come off when they're filling the vehicle with liquid hydrogen. So if it goes over a certain amount, they said if it goes over 4%, that's it. They shut it down, and it becomes an abort. And they worked on it, tried to fix it. Everything was looking good. They were going to go up as late as September 27th, try again. Then Hurricane Ian started coming down the pike, and they thought it would be a good idea to let's put the rocket away. And it eventually went back to the vehicle assembly building, which is good because they did some maintenance, upgrades, and things that they wanted to do. They know that their hydrogen leak system is fixed because they tested that out at the pad. There's certain things have to be changed. The batteries and the flight termination system, FTS system that's on most rockets nowadays, that's designed if something goes, way off course, you don't want this thing coming back into somebody's neighborhood. They either destroy it or self-destruct now. They have autonomous systems built into it as well. But, those charges are powered by batteries. Regular lithium-ion batteries are powering these things. They eventually have to be changed out. There's no way of recharging these things on the pad. They're all independent. The batteries and the explosives themselves all have to be eventually changed out after a certain period of time, like a month or so. Which they did. Just now back in the vehicle assembly building, that's the only place they could do that kind of work. But they, since they had it all apart, to do whatever they had to do with that, there's 10 CubeSats that are planned to be launched when this thing is on the way to the moon. And those CubeSats also have, like, lithium-ion batteries in it. They're starting to go down little by little, because most of them are, like, in a slightly odd position when they're sitting there. So they change out whatever needs to be done there. Also some batteries that are inside the Orion spacecraft itself. Things like the chair that they have this mannequin sitting in. So that chair is all powered by batteries that have dozens and dozens of sensors all over the chair and all over the mannequin. So they, you know, since they got the rocket in the shop, let's keep going. And they change all these batteries. And now they have a new date, the 17th of November. Correction, the 14th. The 14th of November is the new flight date. And it looks like it's going to be in the middle of the night, like just after 12 o'clock at night. So we'll talk about that as the weeks go by. So, they would like to do a daytime launch, but orbital mechanics at that time are not going to allow it. They have to make certain windows to do this flight, and actually change the amount of time that it will go on. Its flight originally I think it was going to be 42 days, and now it's changed to 39 days. But, again, all due to orbital mechanics. We've gone over all the different things they want to do over those 39 days. We'll go over it again as this thing takes off and it's flying for those couple of weeks. Any comments on the SLS, WS2M?
Yeah, it's B2BXO here. Haven't seen much lately on how SpaceX is doing with getting their super rockets ready to go. Anything new on that? Go ahead.
Yeah, hi, Frank. The Starship is still under development, and their booster, for some reason they call their booster now number 24. I guess they haven't gone through 24. They, sometimes they start building them and then they stop. Anyway, number 24, and I think the Starship itself, I think that's numbered. I've been calling that 12. Anyway, they do have both out at the pad now. They were going through a stacking procedure, I think, yesterday or the day before. So they have these big arms that reach out and grab it and lifts up and then puts it onto the stand. Then the arms eventually grab the Starship itself, and that thing puts the Starship on top of the booster. So essentially, it's a two-stage rocket, as you know, Frank. But as they did it, they noticed that something wasn't right, and unfortunately, they're not going to. Well, at this time, they're not going to give any details. But it looked like the weight of the Starship was pushing on the booster, and the booster was moving when it's not supposed to move when they're setting these two together. So it was all stopped, and they put the Starship back down on the ground. And they thought they were going to be rolling it back to work on it, but then they did some other work, and last I heard, they were going to try restacking it again. They keep making modifications, and what I read was apparently one of the modifications on the new booster was a little different than one of the older ones when they were trying to stack it, and I think they had to compensate for that. Who knows what they did? I guess hopefully the information is released. One good thing about NASA, it's really our rocket. It's a government rocket, so extremely transparent. You always find out every little detail of what's going on with all the rockets that are in development, all the ones that have been launched. Private company. We do get a lot of information from SpaceX. They do a pretty good job, but they don't, release all information. And a lot of stuff, I guess, is you know, private. I'm going to keep secret. So hopefully that goes okay. They plan, Elon Musk is still talking about the end of November. What I read is probably highly unlikely. Everything would have to go like super right, you know. But every time he makes a move, he's making a change on Starship. And you make a change, it changes everything else, you know. And this guy changes stuff at will, you know. We're eventually going to have the main construction being done in Florida. You know, he won both construction in Boca Chica, Texas, and Florida going at the same time. He wanted to play one against the other, you know, who's faster. That didn't work out, so it's all being done in Florida, in Boca Chica, Texas. He still has plans on doing it in Florida. And then he set up another launch complex. He was building one in Florida. And apparently it was too close or some kind of a problem relating to Launch Complex 39. They wanted to move something. Anyway, he started taking things apart. It's a very strange happening. He managed to do a lot. I mean, successfully has landed, I don't know, probably almost 100 of these boosters so far successfully. He's got another Falcon 9 Heavy going off. I believe that's going to be coming up in a couple of weeks, maybe November, doing a launch to geosynchronous orbit for the government. He's got two satellites he's going to put up. So he needs to, do a heavy. Two boosters will be recovered. The Centaur is just going to, that's just going to be an expendable vehicle. So, I don't know. Hopefully he'll get this thing up. I hope I'm wrong, but I'm going to predict the first month, maybe the second month of January before he test flies the booster and Starship as one piece, orbit around the Earth, and the first flight he's not going to recover. He's just going to land the booster back in the Gulf of Mexico, and the Starship is going to land in the Pacific Ocean near Hawaii somewhere. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, very good. Yeah, that estimate sounds sort of reasonable. I guess they were probably hoping to beat NASA and get their super rocket off the ground before NASA did. It doesn't look like they're going to succeed, which is kind of incredible considering that, how long it takes NASA to develop anything. Two totally different development philosophies, I guess. The nomenclature is interesting. The second stage, Starship, payload modules, if you will, have their own numbering, and the boosters have their own numbering. So I think the latest incarnation is Booster 8 with Ship 24. I think that's the way they do that. I think ships 1 through 15 were all test articles, and once they got 15 to suicide dive and backflip successfully and land in one piece on a pad and not blow up, they abandoned that test program entirely, apparently, and decided to go for broke and do the orbital launch. Very interesting. And I think they've decided the first payload is actually going to be Starlink satellites. They don't need to bring the Starship back in order to do that. They just need to successfully make low Earth orbit to be able to deploy them. So they're looking to monetize this thing as soon as they can, which is understandable considering the development costs. Go ahead, Paul.
Okay, very good. Yeah, thanks for that, Frank. I wasn't sure. I couldn't remember the booster numbers. You're saying probably up to number 8. And, they've had a lot more starships built, so now they're up to the 24. And I remember a couple of years ago they were crashing these things left and right, and they said that NASA was doing that on a regular basis. You know, they did a lot of that in the very beginning. But they were doing that nowadays on a new vehicle. You know, Congress would say no more. Cut off. Whereas it's a private company, and his philosophy is just fly it, crash it, who cares, build another one. Wow. You know, it's a different philosophy. We'll see. You know, and I don't know, this is on, I found this thing on spacenews.com, I think it was. You've got this couple, Dennis Tito, and now his wife. They want to fly around the moon on a starship. So I guess they're going to pay Elon, you know, mega dollars to do this. They don't want to land on the moon. They just want to, you know, like go there and fly around the moon on a free trajectory return flight. They call that. So Dennis Tito, if you remember back in 2000, he flew on Soyuz rocket. He was the first person to actually be a space tourist. You know, eventually Russia had like eight more people that eventually did that. And now we're stuck. Well, not NASA, but SpaceX is doing that now as well. They've had a couple of flights, actually three flights with people that pay to go up. But anyway, Dennis Tito, he was like, 62 years old, 61 years old when he went up on his flight, stayed for, 10 days or something, and then came back on a Soyuz rocket. And, he loved it. He thought this was the greatest thing. And he's, I guess, a billionaire, you know. He paid, what was cheap back then, it was only $20 million for the seat for a Russian Soyuz flight. But now, all these years later, he's going to pay Elon Musk to get into a starship, and he's going to invite 8 other people, but him and his wife, he just got married to this girl a couple of years ago, and she wants to go on a flight too. I think she flew planes or something. Anyway, that's what they want to do. If you got money, I guess, and Neil won't to send you around the moon, I guess that's what people want to do. So I don't know if you heard that one, Frank. I'm looking at the time. I'll have to make this my final before we turn it back to Roy. Back to you, Frank.
Yeah, okay, very good. I didn't realize it was so late. I'm sitting here working on client document I need to have ready tomorrow. I heard about him before. I didn't know he was gonna do the shot around the moon. They had wanted to do that with a couple of people with Starship. Anyway, it'd be very interesting to see what they accomplish. And I know the federal government is subsidizing them by giving them the contract to do use one of their starships as a so-called human landing system for the Artemis program. I think that design is a bit bizarre because it needs an elevator to bring the astronauts to surface. Because they're going to be too high up in spacecraft when they land. But it sounds like too much mechanical complexity to me. How do you test an elevator to make sure it's going to work properly in the human environment? Anyway, that's know, so I don't know if that's really going to happen or just the federal government's way to subsidize them. very interesting. Anyway, 7-3, I know it's a bit late. Maybe you have to finish what I'm doing here also. And it's a bit of fact here, too. WB2BXL clear. 7-3.
Okay, and yeah, it's NASA is putting out a contract for at least one, maybe two more companies that are going to be able to be part of the human landing system as well. They'll have redundancy, you just won't have SpaceX. I thought that was weird, so yeah, imagine a motorized elevator, and then you get down to the bottom, you push the button, it don't work, now you can't get back up. I hope they have a chain pool, you know. Maybe it's a backup, you know. Chain pulls are great, you know. You could, you know, pull on a one chain round, and it's going to lower you all the way down. It's going to bring you all the way back up. You can stop midway. It doesn't matter. That's what I would do. Anyway, thanks to everybody that listened to us, and we're going to turn it back to Roy to continue. Roy, we'll be on tomorrow night, or the club, Club Info Net, 8:30 on these repeaters. AC2GS, WS2N. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, thank you very much, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And thanks to all of you people out there who participated tonight. I hope you enjoyed yourself. I hope you learned a few things. I hope you taught each other some new things. And once again, if you're not having fun, you're doing it all wrong. So just want to remind people of a few things. Email address is mailbag@ac2gs.com. The link page is roy.ac2gs.com. The audio stream is technet.ac2gs.com. And, of course, Mike KC2NJI's great archive site for technical nets going as far back as December 2006. His amateurradio.tv. He has over 1 million visitors, make it 1,000,001. As Dick, K2RIW, often would end his technical net, be kind to each other. Good advice in general, especially good advice these days. So be good to each other, be kind. You're supposed to have fun with this hobby. Please try your best to do that. And also, I'd like to repeat a quote that has struck me, my fancy. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. Keep that in mind. That's repeated. Anyway, thanks to everyone. Have a great week. Please come back next Sunday at 8 when we're going to try and do this all over again. This is Alpha Charlie 2 Golf Sierra, and I am formally closing this episode of the Limar Technical Net, and I am clear.
And it's WS2N 73. But anybody wants to read a good article, if you're a club member, you get the newsletter. Roy has a good article in that in last month dealing with propagation for antennas. Pretty good. I read that, Roy. Very, very well done. 73, guys.
Thank you, Paul. By the way, that's part one. He ran out of virtual paper, so my article got split in half.
I saw that. Yeah, I saw to be continued in November. To be continued. I thought you were trying to just make it exciting, Roy.
No, I was as surprised as you were to see that split.
That's okay. It's like going to school, you know. You don't want to learn everything at one time. You can't absorb it.
Okay, well, we got a couple of other articles in the chute, so especially if he plans to continue to split them in half, we'll have enough for the rest of the year.
Very, very well done. Very good. Okay, 73, boy. Have a good night. WS2N clear.
AC2GS, NY2H Mobile.
Yes, Lou, how you doing?
Doing okay, actually. I'm picking my door up at the airport. The red eye, I guess you could call it that. We had a couple Wolfsaw connections tonight. First time I saw that. Saskatchewan, Canada. and somebody else. I don't know if you watched that page.
I have it up, but, you know, I'm looking at 15 other things, plus for some strange reason, Echo Link dumped me out of the application at least 5 or 6 times.